This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello everyone, this is Clint Locklear for Trapping Across America. I'm at the North Carolina Convention, and I've got I got to the convention yesterday, and Lynn Ball walked up to me and said, you need to interview Johnny. And it wasn't 20 minutes later, and Biscuit walked up to me and said, you need to go interview Johnny. So guess what? We got Johnny in here this morning. Why don't you introduce yourself, where you're from, who your company is, and in case someone doesn't know who you are.
Yes, I'm John Hunley. Everybody calls me Johnny. I operate the Southeastern Outdoor Supplies. Been in business 48 years, and That's basically about it, I guess.
Well, where are you from?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm from Martinsville, Virginia.
Now, where's that at in the state as far
as? That's south central. We're about 20 miles from North Carolina line, foothills of the Blue Ridge.
Okay, like we're south of 64 or after?
We don't have a major. 220 goes north and south from Greensboro to Roanoke. We're right in halfway in between.
Oh, okay. So you're not that far at all then from
Tennessee. No, we're about nearly 4 hours from here.
All right. So you've been in business for 48 years. I bet business in the industry has changed a lot during that time.
Oh, yeah. It certainly has. A lot of changes.
What would be just some of the things that pop in your mind about the difference between now and 40 years ago?
Well, probably as far as business is concerned, it's the internet, and we're behind times there. We don't have a website, but we print one of the nicer catalogs out there.
And, you do have a good catalog.
So we're still kicking.
Well, how did you get into trapping?
Well, I trapped when I was a kid. I started, I guess, early high school, around ninth grade. Started doing some trapping. I was raised in the foothills, and we didn't have we had a few muskrat where we was at, and of course we'd trap coon and possum and stuff like that. At that time, there was no beaver here, and it's hard to imagine now, but it wasn't. And didn't have otter, and that's basically, I started earlier than that, trapping rabbits, you know, just back then I would sell them, or either we would eat them, of course.
Now, were you using like a box trap type thing, a wood?
For the rabbits, yeah, we did. Used that, and then I made some homemade snares and caught some in.
Was that pretty common with other kids your age at the time?
Well, there was a few that did it, but it wasn't all that many.
Well, I think that's pretty cool. I trap some rabbits every now and then just because they taste good.
Yeah.
And I'm too lazy to go hunt them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So when you were younger, I'm always fascinated by this just personally. How did you get into trapping? I mean, you just didn't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to go catch something.
I think it started with, I'm not sure exactly how I got hooked up with Hallbaker. But it started with me ordering a book, The Trapping North American Fur Bearers, which is still available. And I just got real fascinated with it. And I had an uncle that trapped some. And I would talk to him every chance I got. And I just got real fascinated with it. And started off, my mink was my goal. You know, it was 2 or 3 years before I caught one.
I mean, that was like the Holy Grail.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Well, how did you, I mean, when you got started, I mean, I know you had, you said you had the Hallbaker book,
mm-hmm.
and your uncle probably helped you a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but was it, I mean, it's so vastly different now with all the information mm-hmm. that's out there. How did you go about trying to figure anything out?
Just did on my own, just would set the traps, and if I missed a mink or something, I would figure out why did I miss that mink, and I basically learned it myself, most of it. The book helped a lot, you know, it got me a little head start there.
Were you, on your mink, were you looking for signs or pockets or?
Yeah, I would look, I'd always look for tracks and see what's there. That kind of fascinated me, and I would try to catch them,
How long did it take you before you did catch one?
I think in a couple of years I'd caught a mink or two, and then that was my specialty. After I did that, I really went after the mink. And of course, once I start driving, and the only way you catch a lot of mink, I think, is cover a lot of territory. So I'd run some pretty long lines. You know, I had to do it part time because I worked some too.
Well, I mean, I've never really equated Virginia and mink. I mean, not really. Probably no more than we have in Tennessee. So you had to really probably be a lot more specialized to catch any amount of them.
Yeah, we did. I did. I would run after I started work right after I got married. I was running about 100-mile line, and I'd have to go to work at 8 o'clock, so I had to do that before 8. And of course, back then you could buy gas for 39 cents a gallon, which is
it's only like 42 cents now, isn't it?
Yeah, add a few dollars. But I enjoyed it, and I'd take 40-50 mink a year. It was
that's pretty impressive for Virginia.
Nobody else much. Wouldn't many people, my friends that did trapping, that would catch near that many. But it's the biggest secret was covering a lot of territory, I think.
Were you a blindside guy?
I did both. I did some blindside, a lot of blindsides. That was my favorite set, actually, if you found the right place. But there was places you didn't have a good place to make one, so we did do pocket sets.
Now, I was talking to Claudia last night, and I'm just curious if you've noticed the same thing. Over where he's at, closer to the coast, there's way more food than we have in our part of the world. But he said when you put a pocket for a mink, and unless the temperature got cold enough to stop the coon from running, it didn't. That's when his big catches happened, if he tried to use bait or a pocket. Before that, it was pretty sporadic. In your experience, have you noticed the same thing?
Yes, I have. In the early years, believe it or not, it's hard to imagine not having a lot of coon, but we didn't have a whole lot of coon back in the mountains. And so it wasn't a real big problem. They wasn't worth anything much then, so we'd certainly rather see a mink in a trap or a muskrat one. But you're right. When it was colder, I did have better luck as long as it wasn't frozen. And I would make sets where I'd use a deep part of a bank. In other words, usually one bank is steep and water's deep, and the other one's a sandbar or whatever. I would try to set across from a sandbar on the deep side. And real cold weather, the coon, I think, it kind of discouraged them from swimming over maybe. But the mink would definitely do it, and you'd always have deep water to drown the mink.
So we're using fish or muskrat carcasses?
Muskrat carcasses mostly, if I baited. I didn't bait all the time. Sometimes I take a good lure or mink musk one and shove it back in the hole, shove some leaves or something in behind it, because if he could see the back of the hole and there was nothing there, he might not would swim over.
Mm-hmm.
But I did both, and especially once we got coon, I seemed to use that set a little more than I did earlier. I'd use bait still at some sets, but later in the years, as we got a lot of coon, I would try to discourage them from swimming over by just using a lure, which they still would some, but the bait would attract them more.
So when you started running the 100-mile line, what was the date on that? Just generally?
That was about the time right after I married, which is it was probably about 64 to 70 maybe.
You're making me feel young. I wasn't even born then.
Yeah. I've seen a few years.
So what were the mink worth at that time?
At that time, I've got some old tickets at home, probably getting around $15 to $18. And, as I mentioned, gas was less than a dollar a gallon, so that was pretty good money back then.
I'm trying to, just in my head, if we've lost 80%. So, in today's money, that mink was probably would have been worth close to 80.
Possibly so. I'd have to do some figuring on that. But when you're comparing the price of gas now and other things, even traps,
Man, that's like
that was pretty good money back then. That was the highest price thing out there. At that time, I was doing some land trapping too a little later, and Fox, we had a $2 bounty on Fox, which was worth about what the fur was worth. So they wasn't worth much then. The fur wasn't.
So in your coon at the time, and you're saying they weren't worth what, $1.50, $1.25?
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm.
So that was such a huge difference.
Yeah.
It's backwards.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And when did you beaver trap when they started coming in?
Yes, I caught the very first beaver in our area, about a 3-county area that I covered, and made a quarter page right up in the paper. But yeah, that was, I guess it was probably in, probably around 70, somewhere along there, that we had our first beaver. There were beaver east of my section earlier, of course, but I, as I mentioned, I'm in the foothills, and it was probably in the early 70s.
Well, I've got a good friend at home, D. Scruggs. I think he's just a few years over 70, and he tells me there was a beaver dam 2 counties away that was close to a road, and people on Sunday afternoon after church would drive over like entertainment just to look at the beaver dam.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a strange thing for them to... That's just hard for me to imagine nowadays.
It is hard to imagine now because they're everywhere. But, yeah, actually I covered, it was 2 counties over where I caught my very first beavers, going east, of course, from where I lived. And a farmer had come in my shop there and told me about having them on his farm, and he let me go in and trap them. So.
Well, at that time, you were using a foothold trap?
Yeah, I caught them in foothold trap. Didn't know anything about trapping them other than what I read in the books. And I caught them pretty quick there. I missed a few before I started connecting.
I think that's everybody there.
Yeah.
So you did the mink, and at that time, I mean, I've talked to some older gentlemen before, and mink was... I mean, I don't even know what we could equate that. I don't think we have anything to equate to that today of the, almost like the prestige of being a mink trapper.
Yeah, it's not a lot of people even try to catch them today. I think they've tried maybe and got discouraged. If you just got one stream you're trapping, you're probably not going to catch over 2, 3, or 4 mink at the most, probably. It's just, they're just not thick. I don't know what happens after they raise them and all, where they go to. And they do so much traveling. You'll see his track, and you know, it may be 10 days before that mink comes back there. He's a wanderer.
What advice would you have for someone that was trying to get into mink on our show we do? I would say probably 50% are under the age of 22. And, you know, just in the culture, everything is so... instant gratification that people get frustrated with certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone was wanting to catch mink, which, you know, was really cool, because I mean, when the first time I started trapping in Alaska on mm-hmm. Martin and Fox,
mm-hmm.
and I came back home and I shot beaver during the fur boom because somebody would give me $40 for them. Mm-hmm. I had no idea there was trapping or a fur boom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided I was going to catch mink, and it took me 3 years. And I'll never forget it because it was the coolest thing. My little brother Andrew came up on Christmas morning. On Christmas morning, we went and checked traps, and there was a female mink in a 1.5 Victor. And that was the neatest because, you know, he's never seen one. And up mm-hmm. to that point, besides other people's furs, I've never seen one. And, I mean, there's some of that stuff in trapping. It's worth way more than money
mm-hmm.
from doing that. But what advice, if you were gonna just give advice to someone that's younger to chase mink, what do you think are some of the highlights of that?
Well, I would first look for sign and make sure you do indeed have mink there, and always like to sit in your deep water. And if you got a lot of underbrush and stuff like that where birds can roost and stuff like that, it's usually a good place. I think mink will feed off these birds a lot, catch them at night, the smaller birds. And it's about it. And, you know, to realize that you got to cover a little bit of territory if you catch many of them. But if you're just going after your first mink, I'd probably set a pocket set, or either find his track in a good place where he's more than likely to come back. He'll more than likely come back that same way, and just set a trap and don't bait it.
Were you blind setting in water or on land?
Usually at the confluence of the two, just where shallow water, you know, where they go around a starb or something. I did do some land setting. Some of the streams that had a dam above it, and water would rise and fall. I would get up under the overhanging bank, and I've caught some that way too.
Now, yesterday, when you had no idea that this was even done in the trapping industry, I don't think.
No, I did not. Did not.
And I was trying to explain it to you, and I asked you kind of what you did. Now, I've never talked about this on the show because it's not my wheelhouse at all. Mm-hmm. But when I mentioned ginseng, mm-hmm. I don't know if you knew this or not. Your eyes changed, they lit up, and you smiled. I mean, yeah. It was not that you don't, you know, it's less than trapping, but I mean, I could tell that was a love of yours.
It is. I still to this day, and I've done that since I was a kid, hunt ginseng. A lot of my kin folks, my uncles and so forth, hunted, and I still love to do it. I do it now for the exercise mostly, and I just enjoy it, you know. I can't explain it, you know. I don't do it for the money particularly. I mean, we certainly spend the money that we make off of it, but it's more for exercise and just enjoyment.
Now, do you mind talking about ginseng?
No, I don't mind at all.
Because I'm totally ignorant about it, really. I mean, I know a lot of friends of mine that do it. I've just never really went out and tried it. Ginseng, from what I understand, is in a lot of parts of the country.
Yes.
So it's not just mountains.
More so in mountains, I think. I've never found a lot in real flatland. Then again, I haven't hunted in flatland, but I buy ginseng through my business, and I never buy any east of, probably once you get it out of the rolling land where it gets completely flat, I don't buy any.
Okay.
So I don't think it does real good in just real flat land. It's got to be well-drained soil, I think.
Now, there's got to be regulations, because I've seen online where people get in trouble for...
Yeah.
For digging it too early, or digging the wrong size roots, or kind of how does that work?
Yeah, it's in Virginia. It's governed by the Agriculture Department. Looks after it, and of course the biggest thing as far as getting in trouble doing it is trespassing. And of course the Game Commission looks after that part of it. You do have to have permission to hunt land unless it is public land, and then usually you need a license, like some of the national forests, I think, issue a license to dig ginseng.
Now, is there just a standard license to be a ginseng digger, like a trapping license?
It's just for that particular season, and yeah, it would be very similar to it. I think you have to check in. Some national forest has a limit on what you can dig, I think, and all of them have. Of course, the state has the size limit. It's got to be 5 years old in Virginia. There for a few years, it went to 10 years old. But now it's 5 years old. It's illegal to dig a two-prong. And
please forgive me, but you're using language. I don't know what that means.
Okay. You have your main stalk, and then these branches will come off of it just like a tree. And it's... if it's just two branches coming off of that stalk, that's not a legal root to dig. It's got to be at least 5 years old, and usually by then they have at least three forks off of that stem. And so, and on down the road they get four stalks off of the stem. So,
That's how you tell from the top of the ground what's under the ground.
Yeah, you're not supposed to dig that little two prong. And if you did, it wouldn't be much of a root. And you're supposed to leave the stem on the root. You're supposed to put the berries back in the ground, because a two prong doesn't have berries. It's too young. Occasionally, you may find one that's got a berry on it, but usually it's got to be a three prong to produce the berries, which you cannot take out of the woods in Virginia. You have to dig them back or put them back where you dug your root.
Well, I know I got a wild hare, I don't know, 15 years ago, ginseng got up to, we was at one of the first sales in Tennessee, and somebody brought in, I don't know, I mean, it was bags of ginseng, mm-hmm. and I watched a guy, I mean, he made like $4,000, mm-hmm. and, you know, and I got kind of interested, and I've always been into agriculture on the side anyway, mm-hmm. so I started looking at, well, how do you grow this stuff, and then What crushed my little dream was when I found out that there's a difference between someone that grows ginseng and someone that digs ginseng.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the agriculture department, which in Virginia is what governs, keeps up with it. We have three grades we buy, and we have to keep records of all we buy. They're graded wild, woods grown, and cultivated. And the woods grown is where you just plant it and maybe pull weeds out of it or something like that to promote the growth faster, and don't do anything else. You definitely can't put fertilizer on it.
You can tell that by looking at the roots.
Yes, I can tell. Mm-hmm. And then the cultivated, I don't think we have anybody here much in the East that does that. Places like Wisconsin's real big in cultivated, where they make artificial shade and grow it. But that's altogether different root. It's not near as valuable. It grows much faster.
Well, I remember the price difference was like $40 a pound and $700 a pound.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. Last year it hit $1,000 a pound. The wild did, and the woods grown was about 30% of that, which had been about $300 a pound, and the cultivated was probably in the $30 range. So it was a big difference.
Now, is that a perception of people think it's got like more juju to it if it's wild grown, or is it more chemically concentrated?
You know, I don't know. I have chewed a root, and if I had to take it, I wouldn't give you a dime a pound for it. I didn't see where it did anything. But there is people in the world that think it does. And, I mean, they pay big money for it. And mostly goes to the orange. Korea or China one usually is the big takers of it.
So if I was going to start ginseng hunting, first, you ginseng in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
You mind tell us where you're specifically with a GPS coordinate of where you're ginseng hunting at?
Well, I don't drive, not to holler I'll be in, but I don't drive a long ways. I hunt.
I'm joking.
I've hunted a little bit in Patrick County, and then I live in Henry County and in Franklin County. And that's about as big an area as I go. I don't go that far. And find you some good rich land. Usually after you hunted a while, you know what type of land to look for, which is usually poplar land. Something's fairly rich. I've never found it in pine, although it will grow some in white pine. Oak land doesn't grow it good. It's just a little too poor. So you want the richer land, the black soil, and you get most of that in the big mountains.
Because of the leaf drop.
Yeah, I guess. Yep.
Now, does the only way that the ginseng propagates itself, is it through seeds, or does the roots actually send out enough stuff to do new plants?
No, it's through seed, I'm quite sure. I'm quite sure that's the way it reproduces. Because you'll find that if you find a big four-prong, which is a mature root, mature plant, and around it, you'll find the three prongs and then the two prongs, just where they spread out, because they drop a seed naturally.
Well, I mean, ginseng is one of those things that, I mean, I know a lot of people that do it, and I've heard some of the craziest, and I don't know if half of it or 90% of it's misinformation. You know, they'll say, you know, you need to be on the southern side or the southeastern side of a holler, or, I mean, they've all got their, what they're looking for when they're doing it. I mean, is the southern or northern side of the face make a difference?
You know, I've always heard it grows best on the north side, but I haven't seen that particular. I have actually dug it on all around the mountain. I think, of course, it probably does get hotter on the south side, but if it's got good shade, it still will grow, you know, just fine. It's got to have a little bit of sunlight getting in, and a lot of shade.
Then the steepness doesn't have anything to do with it.
It does need to be, as I mentioned earlier, well-drained soil. If it's swampy, no, I've never found it in the swampy land. It's just got to be well-drained. It certainly will grow on the very steepest land. Some of it you got to pull yourself up, you know, in rock cliffs and stuff. It'll grow there. But it does have to be drained, well-drained soil.
But just from me thinking about this from a a common sense perspective, someone's not just going to go out in the woods and just find pounds and pounds of this stuff a day.
Not likely. Although, you know, you could get up on a patch that nobody had bothered for 20 or 30 years and get in a good patch like that. I've certainly heard of it happening. You know, somebody dig 5 pounds out of one patch. But usually it don't, and especially now it's so many people digging it, it's hard to find the big patches. And I've went out and hunted all day and not found hardly any. You know, if you're hunting new ground, place you've never hunted before.
So once, say I go out and I find legal roots, and then... how do I handle that from that point, or what's the best way to, I mean, because the little shows I've seen on TV about it, I mean, they're like particular about how they dig it up, how they get it back to the house, you know, they're drying it. I've seen electronic, I've seen just regular, you know, almost old school looking stuff. What's the best way once you find a plant? What do?
Well, I've always sold mine dry. I've never sold it wet. And this wet market has just come about in the last, probably within the last 5 years. There is places, especially Korea, that they want it wet, and they're actually buying it wet. You see that a lot in North Carolina and West Virginia. But you got to be hooked up to where you can get it out. You have a deadline to ship it, and it's got to be flown into Korea, China, wherever it goes. And they get a pretty good price for it that way, but I never have sold it that way because I don't buy enough to make it worthwhile. I'm 50 miles from an airport, and so I just buy it wet or dry, and that's the way what I dig. I dry it. So I just wash it with my bare hands, rub it a little bit, you know, to get all the dirt off. You want the rings to show up in the roots, so you don't take a toothbrush or something like that and scrub it. They don't like it real white. They want to see those growth rings. And that's where the larger the plant, you'll have more of those growth rings. And so you want all the loose dirt out, but you don't want to scrape it out of those little crevices there where the rings are. So that's the way I do it, and then I just put it up and slow dry it, house temperature. There's ways to speed up the drying, but usually I'm in no hurry. What I dig and just let it dry and spread it out in the house somewhere and where there's no moisture and let it dry naturally.
Would a dehydrator hurt it?
Yeah, you're going to lose some weight. You definitely don't want to use a microwave. You don't have anything but crust left.
I would never thought of a microwave.
I've seen people that do it, but you don't want to do that. And I think anytime you speed it up a lot, you lose some weight.
How much moisture do you think you lose when you do dry it?
It takes, it depends on the time of the year you dig it, because they have seasons now, and they've shortened the season some. In Virginia, it doesn't open until September the 1st for digging. And at that time, it's probably about 3.5 pounds of green will dry out to 1 pound of dry. That's about the ratio. Back earlier, when you didn't have a starting point, they would dig it in July and August, it would take about 4 pounds of green to dry a pound of dry it to be a pound.
And how late in the year can you technically should or legally should dig it?
Well, actually, the season in Virginia is open to the end of December, but it's nearly impossible to find it after mid-November. What happens when it frosts, it usually it kills some of the plant if any of the frost can get into it, but usually in the woods, a lot of the frost don't get to it. But once the leaves comes off the trees, it the stem would just turn loose there at the root, and it just covers it all up, and it's basically over with. And sometimes you can find just a stem sticking up if you know exactly what to look for and dig it from that stem. But it definitely loses all its leaves there about in Virginia around the end of October. So that's about as 1st of November would be about as late as I would even try to look for it.
I mean, to me, that's just so cool, actually, that you can go out and just with some knowledge of plants and find something that's that valuable just in the woods.
Yep.
That's amazing to me. Now, you also buy fir, don't you?
Yes, I do.
And how long have you been buying fir?
I've been buying fir, I think I started probably in... probably about early 70s, 71, 72, somewhere along there.
Are you still buying today?
Yes, I am.
And one of the things I've always been curious of is, and I've seen it at our fur sale, some of the older guys will come in, they hadn't trapped in a long time, and they'll have square raccoons. What time of the century did that change over, and why, do you know? I think they look kind of neat that way.
Yeah, it was different. It probably changed in the mid 70s. It started changing. Once in a while, even now, an old timer will put up a coon that way. And most of the that put them up that way were the dog hunters that they had coon hounds. Yeah, but now it's changed now. You know, a lot of them are putting up the fur good, and it's still some of it handled pretty rough, but I don't know if anybody much does it the old square way anymore.
Well, what else has changed in the fur industry from when you started to now? Is that about the only thing?
Well, no, it's probably the biggest thing is the fur auctions has changed it a lot. The little country buyer, he's still used. The guy that wants his money pretty quick, they use us small country buyers, and there's some of them that just wants to see the fur sold and don't want to wait for the money and trust what they'll get for it. But that's probably the biggest thing. But fur handling has gotten better, and the fur auction people have promoted that through the little magazines and different things, and it's handled a lot better than it was.
I know for 10 hours yesterday, I with the Napa next to me, they've been playing that muskrat video. I mean, hopefully they can get them to put a different one in today. I was dreaming about using a spoon on muskrats last night for that video all day. Do you see as a fur buyer a big difference between wood and wire?
I have seen some stain from using rusty stretchers, wire stretchers. I can see where with cats and, red fox maybe, or gray foxes too, to where that the wooden ones would be better. And I'm seeing a little changeover. It started just real recently, the last couple, 3 years, they've started by using more and more of the boards.
Do you think it's just from an appearance point of view, or one thing I've talked to some other guys, and they go, you know, a lot of times trappers get so wrapped up into that part of how they're putting the fur up, but when it goes to Napa, a number two coon on wire and a number two coon on wood is still a number two coon. They don't have a separate pile for wood and
mm-hmm.
wire.
Mm-hmm.
So is it really worth the extra time?
Well, if fur is spraying a pretty good price, I think it might be. These boys can take you wood stretches and on a coon, for instance, and lots of the time they get one extra size out of it.
That could be pretty big.
That could be big, especially if your coon was selling good. It would pay for your wooden stretches real quick.
Well, I know when we went to, we do a lot of cats from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went from wire to wood on cats, I couldn't really tell that big a difference until I went to the Nevada style. You know, mm-hmm. we have the legs up, so you got mm-hmm. spots from throat down. That seemed to make a difference on price. But the look of the cat on the wood, because the South Texas where we go, the hair is about like it is here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's, well, not here, but kind of like when me and you're at it, more on that parallel.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very bright and got big spots on them and all that. But the wood, because the wood was thicker, when you handled one, it was like your brain, this has got more fur on it. And I could take that same cat, put it on wire, and it would be thin because it'd be mm-hmm. just as thin as that.
Yeah.
And I know it made a psychological difference to me.
Yeah, it really helped the cat. The boys that's doing that, and it's not many of them in my area that's doing it like that. They're using boards, but as far as putting the legs up, and I've seen them like that, and they really show the spots. There's not a lot of them that's doing that yet, especially if they intend to sell it to somebody like me. But I can see where that would help it.
Now, what is your, do you get nervous when you see, like when we do cats, you know, we keep borax in business, you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of other guys that trap out west. The reason we do it more than anything else is because it can be, when we're trapping cats in Texas, it can go from 60 to be 110 in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's terrible on the fur.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do it to try to make sure nothing falls off.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem to make them look better. From a fur buyer's point of view, when you see borax just on an animal, are you thinking someone's trying to hide something? Or do you think that's, what's going on in your mind about that?
Well, I'll ask the customer, what have you got on it? It makes me a little nervous sometimes. I've had the people I would sell to mention the fact that they would ask me what's on it, and they didn't particularly like it. I'm seeing a little more than usual. So, and it's going through okay. So I'm okay.
So you're not getting docked on it on your end?
No, not unless it's gotten real hard. Sometime I've seen pelts that would actually, it'd be so stiff you could bend it and it would crack a little. And I definitely didn't like that. And that might have just been from drying, I'm not sure what. Or maybe they had something else on it other than borax.
Hmm.
It's not, I don't run up on that a lot here. You know, there's a few of the boys that put it, especially in just places like under the front leg or something where it might be, get tainted or something. But it's not a big problem for me.
That's pretty cool. One of the issues, you may have something, you may have an idea on this. In the winter, when I was catching a lot of beaver, I always had problems with mushrooms growing on those things if I kept them too long from the humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to wire, which seemed to help, but it didn't do anything. So, I mean, you're not southern like what I consider southern, mm-hmm. where you're at in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
but what is the best way that you know of from being in business that long, once you catch that fur, to keep it in the best shape until you sell it?
The fur we put up, we basically have to use a wire because it just, we can hang them 2 inches apart, and you know, we can put a lot in a drying room where the boards take up so much room. And the boards are, you know, if you're buying plywood, it's pretty darn expensive, you know, to mm-hmm. buy it. But actually, I do like it better on wood. You know, a lot of my customers do put it on that, and it's I think you can get an extra size there too. We was talking about wood versus wire for getting a little more size, and a lot of times you can pick up a size on a beaver using the wood, I think.
Well, since you said that, I'm going to ask you, since you're a fur buyer, when I first started trapping beaver in number, I was going off of size. Mm-hmm. And where I live is basically on the Alabama-Georgia line, part of Tennessee, way down south.
Mm-hmm.
And it would get really, really weak on when I put them on. If I got any tightness on the stretcher, mm-hmm. it would get very weak on the flanks, mm-hmm. and it would look bad.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've done, and I don't know if it's the right or the wrong way, I would actually make the stretcher smaller than the beaver and let the beaver stretch to the or dry to the stretcher to try to make it look fuller, even though I would lose size. To me, it would look like a better hide when I did that.
Yeah, it would certainly feel thicker. Fur would be thicker on it, and but you would lose a size now and then, I'm sure. Doing it that way.
Is the size on a beaver more important than the quality of the fur?
You know, in my buying, I measure them all and I just go by the yardstick. I can see where on the big auctions, though, where they certainly would go in a little better grade, probably, where they were thicker.
Okay. Well, we're got to go back in there and do what we came for, but mm-hmm. the last thing I'm going to ask about, do you ever meet Lee Barber from North Carolina?
Lee Barber.
Mm-hmm.
I know. No, you're talking about Good Day. His name's not Lee though. The one I know is a big fur buyer. Used to buy a lot of fur. Yeah. Lincoln Barber.
Lincoln, that's right.
Lincoln Barber. Yeah, I know Lincoln well. I actually in my early years I sold Lincoln some fur. I mean, even after I started buying, I sold him fur because he was biggest around. Which Lincoln's like myself, he's getting a little age on him now. But I like Lincoln.
Me and Newt were trapping here close to Washington in North Carolina, so we went up and sold some fur because mm-hmm. we needed gas money.
Mm-hmm.
And me and Newt, we're catching otter, doing pretty good. And I kind of was doing the beaver and otter, and he was handling everything else. And the way that I've seen the tails on the otter, you know, you pleat them and you make them short mm-hmm. and you do all this. And, you know, there's a lot of time involved in that mm-hmm. to get that look right. Well, when I went down to Lincoln, that makes better sense now since you said mm-hmm. that than Lee, but Lincoln, and I was watching his guys put those up. They would pull them down to where they had to be 18 inches or 14 mm-hmm. inches and tack them, then go out on each side with one tack each, and that's what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any difference whatsoever? Because I'd much rather do what they were doing than what I was doing.
Well, you know, I buy them this pleated and the other way too. And when I measure a pelt, I just measure down to where it goes around the stretcher. And the tail meant nothing to me as a small fur buyer because the people I dealt with, they didn't request that we pleat the tail. I'm not sure. You'd have to ask some of the auction people exactly what that does to it, unless it makes your fur thicker, maybe feel like we was talking about on the beaver a while ago. Maybe it makes it seem thicker or fuller or something, but I certainly don't require it. Either way is okay with me.
So it didn't seem to matter one way?
Yeah. I can see where it would take longer to pleat it. Well, I would think it would.
Oh, it definitely does.
Yeah, I put them up and I never did pleat them, but that's just come about in the last 5 or so years mm-hmm. pleating, I think.
Well, sometimes I wonder if some of this stuff that becomes so popular, someone does it and somebody else doesn't, for you know what everybody else is doing it, no one really knows why mm-hmm. anybody's doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, man, I greatly appreciate you talking with us.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Enjoyed it.
any last words of wisdom to anybody out there about trapping? Any philosophy or anything like that?
No, we just need to make sure if we can carry a kid with us or something, you know, show him. And that's stressed a lot more now than it used to be back when I mentioned to you that I had helped organize the Virginia Trap Association. I was the first president, and that wasn't stressed as much back then as it is now. But I think you do need to, you know, take a youngster with you and show him some stuff.
Well, cool deal. Well, I appreciate it, man. I really do.
Yes, sir.